We're here on that matter today. Council, before we begin, I'm going to ask you, when you are not speaking, to please mute your microphone. The marshal will show the running clock. Please keep an eye on your time. And I'm going to ask you to identify yourself before you begin your argument and your client. Each party will have 15 minutes for argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. And with that, Council, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. Am I coming through?
You are. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Gerald Moncorf, Rincon Union, St. Cloud for the plaintiff. Together, the two great Minnesota constitutional education cases, Skeen and Cruz Guzman, establish principles that, if implemented, could reverse Minnesota's two decades-long failure and to remedy the near worst achievement gap in the nation, and better address the educational needs of the thousands of students that our education system now leaves behind. However, the district court's decision and the state's position here build what amounts to a defensive firewall around the implementation of the Skeen and Cruz-Guzman principles, and really render the Skeen and Cruz-Guzman principles illusory. The Skeen decision says that the state satisfies its constitutionally imposed education clause duty of creating a general and uniform system of education when it provides, and I quote, funding to each student in the state in an amount sufficient to generate an adequate level of education which meets all state standards.
Council?
Yes, ma'am.
When I look at the plain language of the Education Clause in the Minnesota Constitution, it appears to be a mandate to the legislature to ensure that adequate funding. And in this case, the plaintiff and the appellant has named as defendants a number of entities. How is it that any of the entities other than the legislature are proper parties to a claim arising under the Education Clause when the Education Clause mandates that the legislature affirmatively do something?
The system that's been established requires the legislature to work with the governor to figure out what the cost of meeting state standards are. Governor Pawlenty saw that in 2004. He was actually in the Skeen case and recognized that in order to, for the legislature to do its job in the budgeting process, the state and the Department of Education need to provide the legislature with the information it needs to do its work.
What does the Department of Education have to do?
They need to provide information on the cost that the legislature needs in order to fund enough to meet state standards.
So the claim that is you're asserting is that the Department of Education, for example, hasn't provided the information necessary for the legislature to do its job. Is that your claim?
The legislature has asked the Department of Education to provide information on the special education cost, and that is regularly provided. And the legislature ignores that cost in its funding.
So then is there actually really a claim against the Department of Education and its commissioner? I mean, are you asserting the Education Clause count against the DOE and its commissioner or not?
Yes.
And what is that cause of action?
The Skeen decision was against the state and the Department of Education. The Department of Education has a responsibility, coordinate with the legislature, to provide that system. And I don't think that it's possible for the legislature to do its job in building highways or preparing an appropriate education for the to appropriate money without information from the Department of Education as to the cost.
So let me ask it a different way. What's the legal basis for that liability?
It lies in the Constitution.
Is this a plain language argument that you're making, or?
I think the Supreme Court in Skene did not just issue its mandate to the legislature, but also to the Department of Education. The plain language of the Constitution, the court said, is sui generis, is a special mandate to the government to provide an appropriate, adequate education.
When I read Skene, it just says, in sum, that the state of Minnesota provides an adequate funding and education for the students. I don't see that it singled out any particular agency. It talked about the legislative way of doing funding. So I'm not seeing how you say that Skene says that the Department of Education is a proper state agency to be in a suit like this.
I think the Department of Education was a party in both Skene and Cruz Guzman.
I had a question about your equal protection claim, and the district court treated it as a disparate impact claim and found that there that you didn't show discriminatory intent on the basis of any suspect class status. Do you agree with that reading of the district court order?
The equal protection claim arises from the uniformity clause and the Skene decision.
No, but I'm saying the district court here, that we recognize two types of equal protection claims. One is disparate treatment and the other is disparate impact. And the district court analyzed your equal protection claim as one of disparate impact. Do you agree with that?
The state has indicated in its brief that it intentionally refuses to provide
That's not my question. My question is about the district court's analysis of your equal protection claim. And the district court, when I read the order, treated it or analyzed it under the disparate impact analysis.
Yes.
And found that the claim failed because you didn't state a claim with regard to the second prong of that test, which is a discriminatory intent on the basis of any suspect class status.
Yes, the Skene found that the...
Then my question in reading the district court order and in reading your appeal, I don't see that you challenged this determination by the district court.
That may be true.
I didn't see it in your brief.
We have regarded the fundamental right under Skeen as arising from the right to an adequate education. The state provides an adequate education. As I read their position, to students who are not disadvantaged. State says that the Constitution provides some form of adequate education funding, but it does not, but the funding that it provides to English language learners, students of poverty, and students receiving special education, that standard, that funding is not required under the strict scrutiny requirement. And so the, Skeen said that this is a fundamental right, that the fundamental right arises from the constitutional right, not because those people are in a suspect class. Does that answer your question? Oh, you're muted.
Yeah, not really, but so another question I have is with regard to the St. Cloud School District as a party, which it isn't. So as I understand this, the statutes, if state and federal aid isn't sufficient to pay for the special education services, then school districts have to fund that deficit through other means. And that would be under Minnesota Statute 123B.02 subdivision 8.
That is correct.
And so it seems under that statutory scheme that the St. Cloud School District should be a party to this.
The district does provide the deficit. They're not violating, the district is not violating the requirement to provide special education. The way the system works is that the district is shorted $13 million annually for special education, and they are required to pull that money out of the funding that's provided to other students. The state calls that the cross subsidy. The difference is that 70% of the students in the St. Cloud District are themselves underfunded. You follow me? The state doesn't fully fund education for English language learners. The state doesn't fully fund education for low-income students, students of poverty that the state requires. So,
Council, this raises another question that I have regarding the request for relief that you're seeking. You say on page 22 of your brief that this is a Marbury case, that it's the function of the judicial branch to say what the law is. But you're asking us, and you're asking the district court to do far more than just saying what the law is. In the request for relief, you're asking for reallocation of funds, orders to the legislature and coordinate branches of government to do a particular thing. You're asking for the submission of plans to the district court for review and approval. What I'm missing from your brief is the legal authority for the relief that you are requesting.
So I think that the relief we're requesting is really quite modest compared to the reliefs that's being allowed in Cruz Guzman.
It's not a matter of whether it's a lot of relief or a little relief. It's what's the authority for us to do any of the things that you're asking us to do.
The authority is equitable. And the question is, what is the appropriate relief when the state is refusing to comply with the Constitution? We advocated first and foremost that the state be required to determine so that the legislature has in front of it the full cost of meeting state standards. This was something that the state initiated in 2004 because the state recognized they could not do the scheme, they could not implement scheme without providing the legislature that cost. The governor undertook that responsibility, and just as they were about to provide that information, he terminated that process. And so the first step, in our view, of relief would be to require the state to provide that information to the legislature.
All right, thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes go ahead, Ms. Judge Reyes. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. I just have one quick question. I don't see anywhere in your brief any response to the issue that the governor and the legislature are improper parties. And it seems to me because you don't have any response either in your initial brief or in your reply brief, that issue is forfeited. Am I wrong to make that assumption?
I don't believe that it is correct that we failed to respond to the argument that the legislature is not a proper party. We cited explicitly the language in Cruz Guzman that said that there is no legislative immunity in a scheme in an education clause enforcement. And what the state is trying to do with the governor is for the governor to borrow the legislature's immunity. And the legislature has no immunity. So no, I certainly don't agree that we waived that argument. It's quite clearly in our brief.
Anything else, Judge Reyes?
No, thank you.
Judge Riley, anything else? Thank you very much. Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Casserly.
May it please the court, Your Honor's counsel, I'm Martha Casserly, Assistant Attorney General, and I represent all state respondents. Respondents respectfully request the court to affirm the district court's denial of temporary injunction and dismissal of the case. This lawsuit is not the proper vehicle for advancing the appellant organization preferred education funding policies. Appellant's claims are procedurally and substantively flawed. In short, this lawsuit lacks a proper plaintiff, a necessary defendant. It names immune defendants and fails to state a claim for which the courts can grant relief. I will briefly address two significant concerns, lack of standing and failure to state a claim. Due to the lack of standing of appellant organization in bringing this lawsuit, appellant is essentially seeking an advisory opinion from this court for its educational professionals and community members. Appellant fails to qualify for associational standing because his amended complaint fails to show that members of his organization have a personal, individual injury in fact, fairly traceable to respondents' system of funding public schools.
But counsel, wouldn't you agree that the party or the individuals that hold the right under the education clause are the students who would be entitled to an adequate education?
Yes. Students were, go ahead.
And if that is the case, then the parents of students who would be entitled to a adequate public school education would have standing to assert those rights on their behalf, correct?
They were currently attending it, yes, based on the Forsland, Cruz Guzman, and Skeen cases, yes.
Why do they have to be currently attending? For example, if I'm the parent of a student who is disadvantaged in some way, say they have dyslexia, and I realize that my 8-year-old cannot get an adequate education at a public school and I choose to send them to a private school instead, my student is still aggrieved because they're not able to get an adequate education. So why wouldn't they have the right to assert a claim also?
They, Your Honor, in order to qualify for standing, they would have to show that they're being harmed by what has happened and that the relief sought would be traceable to the alleged acts. So the complaint does not specify that specific situation where someone was attending the school district and then left for a different matter. Instead, the amended complaint has generalized claims. But
some of those allegations do provide that some members, not all, but some of the members of SCRAC are parents of children, disadvantaged children, in the St. Cloud School District. So why isn't that enough to confer associational standing?
It would be the St. Cloud School District, and none of them, as the district court found, show that they were currently attending the St. Cloud School District. So they allege that by not naming current parents who children currently attend the school district, they failed to show that the relief that they're seeking would provide a remedy to those students. So they failed to show that for purposes of standing. As the district court noted, a number of places have claimed that these board members were parents of children with disadvantages, but none of them, as the district court held, showed that they were current members, which would receive the benefits of this lawsuit. Instead, this lawsuit is seeking an advisory opinion for these community members and education officials. So they haven't shown in the amended complaint that they would directly benefit from this lawsuit. So for
those counsel, reasons, your argument that this is an advisory opinion, I don't see that in your brief at all. And they're actually asking, to the contrary, I think they're asking for a very, very specific relief. But I'm still struggling to understand why parents with children, school-age children, would not have standing, because, as Judge Frisch highlighted, what if they're not attending because they're not getting the adequate education that they're getting? And I think that the complaint certainly has enough in terms of the harm that is caused by the state, the allegation that there's harm caused by the state by improper funding. There's certainly sufficient information there.
If the, Your Honor, the amended complaint had alleged that they were parents of students who were currently attending the district, it doesn't mean actually attending the public school. That would be a different complaint that we would be addressing here. Instead, it is alleged members are educational professional community members. And
right, I understand that there are disadvantages. Counsel, I understand that there are additional people, but I think the focus really is on the fact that there are parents with students, and I think that's the key issue there, not whether or not there are other interested members that may or may not have standing.
Yes, and this amended complaint does not allege that there are parents of children currently attending the district, if the amended complaint has cited the example that you or Judge Frisch has cited about an 8-year-old student, we would be having a different complaint in front of us, but we don't have that complaint in front of us. And so they failed to allege specific particularized harms. Instead, it's generalized claims of injury such as property, home values, district reputation.
Well, counsel, there are additional allegations, and I understand your argument in terms of home values, but I think there seems to be enough there in terms of the harm to students who are not being adequately funded. I wonder if you could turn to the second issue that you'd raised in terms of failure to state a claim. I'm curious as to which claim or claims you're focusing on there.
Sure, yes. Minnesota's education funding system distributes funds to local school districts in a uniform manner that sufficiently supports basic education programs for all students, including targeted funding to meet the educational needs of pupils who enroll under PREPARED. The amended complaint raises a claim under the Education Clause and two claims under the Equal Protection. Under the Education Clause, the appellant alleges that school officials could do more if the district received more funding than other districts.
That's one of their claims. I mean, they're asking also the yes-no question that's posed in Cruz Guzman. They're asking a thumbs up or a thumbs down on the funding system as a whole. So why isn't that a justiciable, viable claim, just as a matter of declaratory rights?
Your Honor, that is correct, that count number one, that the in the complaint, that the plaintiff organization is seeking a declaratory action, finding and declaring that Minnesota's education funding system violates the Education Clause and Equal Protection Clause. If that lawsuit ended there, we would be having different situation in front of us, but they're seeking for specific funding, mandatory funding and action on the part of the school district.
And I get that, and that part is troubling to me, as I did indicate to counsel, but I mean, these are claims that can be separated. Is the entire complaint defective because plaintiff is asking for something more in addition to the yes-no question that Cruz Guzman says is a viable claim, or can we just separate the claims in the complaint, the viable claims in the complaint, the justiciable claims in the complaint?
I would propose no, Your Honor, that the amended complaint has multiple procedural defects in not having a properly cut, not showing that they have associational standing in naming immune parties, in failing to bring in the party that could provide the relief.
I get all of those other additional claims that you have to knock the whole complaint out. What I'm wondering is, as a matter of justiciability, are you saying that the entire complaint is defective when the plaintiff asks for something more than just the Declaration of Constitutional Rights?
Yes.
Why? What's the legal basis of that, for that proposition?
It's not the role of our courts to edit and revise the amended complaint so that they raise justiciable claims. If we had a different complaint before us, you know, the state's responses would be different. This just isn't the correct, proper vehicle in to just disregard other parts that don't fit in. And would propose that this amended complaint that was before the district court and that's before this court does not have substantive and procedural defects. And so that the what the plaintiff is seeking is beyond what the court can provide here. If we had a different
I don't think I'm tracking what your argument is, because, well, let me put it this way. I don't think you're answering Judge Frisch's question. When I read the complaint and when I read the briefs, I see at least two separate issues being raised. One is the question of whether or not the respondents have violated the Constitution and violated appellants' constitutional rights under the Education Clause and Equal Protection Clause. In other words, they're saying, can you decide, District Court, can you decide Court of Appeals, have they violated the Constitution under the Equal Protection Clause and the Education Clause? That, to me, is a yes or no question. There's a second set of relief that they're asking for, which is with respect to certain action that they are asking us to require of respondents. Let's assume for the sake of argument that we agree with you that we cannot undertake, there's a separation of powers issue with those that you have raised. And let's assume we agree with you that we as a judiciary cannot tell the legislature or the governor what to do, okay? But that first issue of whether there is a constitutional violation, why can't we just address that issue? Why isn't that a valid claim for us to decide yes or no?
Thank you, Yana, for clarifying the question. The state has written in the brief that it is solely to review the claims under the Education and Equal Protection Clauses that the appellant organization still fails to state a claim for relief. First, under the Education Clause, again, it argued the argument that school officials could do more if the district received more funding does not constitute a violation of the Education Clause. The Equal Protection claims fare no better. Appellant claims, as they did this morning, that an equal claims is equal protection violation based on a fundamental right to an education. But the Minnesota Supreme Court was clear in Skeen that it does not apply the fundamental right analysis to funding cases. There is no fundamental right to any particular funding scheme. The point being that this amended complaint has not shown it would be entitled to an equal protection, that it would be entitled to proceed under the equal protection argument. The Minnesota education funding system, which must be presumed, satisfies the rational basis review. Because appellant did not argue that the St. Cloud School District received less funding per than other similarly situated school districts, but rather argues that she received more, as the district court held, it failed to state a claim for equal protection clause based upon education. And the second equal protection argument, appellant seeks to have a group of so-called students with disadvantages, and that is not a class at all for purposes of appellant equal protection claim.
Well, there's at least one class in there that's protected, and that's people of color.
That and the appellant's complaint did not single out people of color. Instead, it lumps a group of categories of students that it calls disadvantaged students, but none of them, that group is not tied together. The only thing that ties them together is the alleged shared harm by the challenged government system. So if we had a different group than what's in the complaint here, maybe they may have a cause of action. But here is a group, is an appellant organization called the Students with Disadvantages, which are those of English learners, those who come from, those for English is not their first language, students that come from poverty home. And the only tie between this group that the appellant has created is that of the harm, and that is not a class for purposes of an equal protection claim.
So in terms of your constitutional argument, if the legislature and the governor passed and signed a bill that gave schools across the state $1 million for all the schools, and school districts said, wait a minute, that's simply not enough to provide the education that, to provide that minimum floor education that Cruz Guzman talked about, would you still argue that there's no viable claim under the Equal Protection Clause, or better yet, under the Education Clause?
$1 million for all school districts?
Correct.
I think I, under the Cruz-Guzman standard, the Minnesota legislature, the state of Minnesota, must provide a funding that is uniform and provide sufficient funding to provide an adequate education to all students in Minnesota. I think a question would be raised that that would not, $1 million to all school districts would not meet the Cruz-Guzman standard. And so there could be the Skeen case allowed a challenge for by parents with students currently attending district for lack of funding, for a complaint about the funding. There can be a case to be brought under the Education and Equal Protection Clause.
Okay, and, so thank you, counsel. So why isn't there a viable claim, at least under the Education Clause here, when the allegation is there is not sufficient funding for all students, which is what is required, because there are some students that do not have sufficient funding? Why does that claim not survive a Rule 12 motion to dismiss at this stage of the litigation to move forward?
It did not meet the motion to dismiss because the St. Cloud School District, the complaint is not that the St. Cloud School District is not receiving as much funds as the other school district. The point is the St. Cloud School District is receiving actually more funding than its neighboring school districts. And so it's going to depend on what the complaint is about the funding system. For $1 million for the entire state, that's a serious question about adequacy. In this case, the facts that are presented here that the St. Cloud School District is receiving as much funding as the other school districts, and it has not shown the direct traceability to the harm. And as pointed out in the briefs, Minnesota legislature has set forth an extensive amount of categorical funding for certain categories of students who enroll underprepared, English
but,
learners.
But the appellants, first of all, we need to view the record in the light most favorable to appellants at this stage. And one of the things that they argue is that their school district is very different than surrounding districts. In fact, it is more akin to Minneapolis and St. Paul in terms of diversity and in terms of students that have special needs. So I'm not sure that comparison really stands up, especially when we have to look at the complaint in the light most favorable to appellants.
Yes, but at the amended complaint does not establish that this that the school district is receiving less funding, and the we have the facts that are presented before us in this case in the amended complaint, as the court said, must refer it to the facts as stated in the complaint. But the amended complaint is alleging that not that they're not receiving funding as compared to other districts, that they should receive more, and that simply does not state a claim under the Education Clause or the Equal Protection Clause.
All right, thank you, counsel. Anything else, Judge Reyes, Judge Riley? Thank you very much. Counsel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. The state is misreading completely what Skeen holds. The state is actually making the argument that Justice Thomjohnanis, I can't say the name, Esther Thomjohnanis, made in her dissent. In Skeen, the plaintiffs argued that they had a right to equal funding with all other districts. And the state responded and said, no, equality of funding is not the test under the Constitution. The test is, does each district get enough funding to meet all state standards? They said the state standards are what all districts are required. They actually got a stipulation on that, and they said our responsibility under the Constitution is to deliver uniform education that equals state standards. And the court agreed with that. That's why in the Skeen case and Cruz Guzman, an education that meets all state standards is equated with an adequate education. The two are one and the same. On the state standards, as they exist now, require set proficiency and programmatic standards that make it more costly to educate kids who come to the school district behind than others. So then the court said, where is the dividing line, the Supreme Court, where's the dividing line between rational basis and strict scrutiny fundamental right? And the court says, as to an education that is required to meet all state standards, that is a fundamental right. It's not strict, it is not rational basis. But here in Skeen, the plaintiffs were asking for extra money to do extra things that went beyond state standards. They stipulated that their students were meeting state standards as they existed in those days. And the court said, when you're asking for more money than necessary to provide an adequate education that meets state standards, then the rational basis test applies. Justice Page dissented. He said, no, that's not good enough. Justice Tom Donvis, he actually joined in part, but the clear standard in Skeen is the legislature sets the standards. Those standards are uniform across the state. When the legislature sets uniform standards, the basic education is what the legislature says all districts must provide. And the claim in this case is that the state is doing exactly what the state says it's doing. As to the students with educational disadvantages, Black students, English language learners, who by the way are a protected class under federal law, as to those students, the state is saying, you're on your own, rational basis, we'll give you whatever we want to. And the 70% of the students in District 742, all of whom are underfunded, when a parent sends a child to the District 742, they are fearing that they're sending their kids to a classroom, 70% of the students not adequately funded. Where is that money coming from? What basically the state is doing is imposing an tax on students in the district to cover what they call the cross subsidy. The cross subsidy just for special education in the school district in St. Cloud is the state underfunds $5,600 on the average for each special ed student, but they underfund all of the surrounding districts $2,000 less. That's a rational basis, they evidently, but districts with advantage students are receiving they have $2,000 less of a loss than the district with 70% who are disadvantaged. And this is what is driving what we call in Minneapolis and St. Paul, the downward spiral of school districts, where more and more kids don't meet state standards. More and more parents fear to send their kids there. They go somewhere else. Less and less of the students in the district are adequately funded, and more the district is perceived as failing. And this downward... Yes.
Council, I see that your time has expired. Thank you very much. Council, I want to thank all of you very much for a well-briefed, well-argued case. I am very happy that we were able to get this oral argument scheduled and provide access to all of you. Thank you very much. We will take this matter under advisement and issue an opinion within 90 days. Thank you, everyone. Stay safe and well.
Thank you both.
Thank you, Yannick.
We are adjourned.